And yes, it's right out of Waiting for Guffman, the community theater. And the community theater was a place where early on I got the sense that this was a group of people coming together to celebrate, and together, through storytelling, we were creating this magic. And I was smitten by that experience. And then years later, right before we moved to Mexico, I had a day in New York that truly changed the way I thought about design and space and really kind of launched the way our studio has been thinking about this subject. We came into New York with four older brothers, and I went to Schraff's for lunch. It was the first New York restaurant experience. And I don't remember the way the place looked. What I remember is how it felt. I remember the relationship between the tables. I also remember that dining with my four brothers was no longer a competitive art form, who could get the last piece of steak. There was a kind of sense memory to it that was extraordinary and very communal. And from there, we went to the Imperial Theater to see Fiddler on the Roof, which was really a seminal thing for me that I've obviously post-rationalized and thought about, as designers do. But it was 1,300 strangers, including me, going into this space, and through the magic of storytelling became a community. So there was a, for the time of the show, there was this kind of bond, and it made me fall in love with New York, it made me fall in love with theater, and it intrigued me about the idea of celebrating in a live communal way. We moved to Guadalajara, Mexico, which couldn't have been more different than Deal, New Jersey, other than 8,000 feet above sea level, so you'd pass out if you ran more than 100 yards. It was Deal turned inside out. It was all public realm. The house was a walled, small space the size of this stage, but it faced an avenue full of roses. It led to a marketplace that sat next to a bullring, next to Mariachi Square. It was urban theater, and it was amazingly seductive. And I paid attention to the spectacles that happened in the space, but also the rituals that connected them and the richness of the rituals. So that interest and really obsession in public space and celebration continued through architecture school, both in Syracuse and in London. And it was clear to me that the dialogue about buildings is mostly about the buildings. It certainly was in school. And I was interested in the communal experience, the community-driven experience that forms the lives and prepares the lives that live inside of buildings. I was interested in looking at it from the inside out. And that's really been the body of my work in the city for the last 22 years, creating spaces that contain that experience. I overlook Union Square, which is an incredible space, and like Bryant Park, is a different spectacle every day. Transformable, totally immersive, all different, but all sharing the notion that these are people who are seeking a live, participatory, unprogrammed, unmediated experience. And what we've found is so rich and wonderful about New York is creating places that contain that. In thinking about the book, the research started by realizing that we wanted to reach out to people in the world who were big picture thinkers and big picture makers of spectacle. And if you think about New York, most of the images, sort of icons of New York, are from the air. It's a bird's eye view, and it's a very neatly organized city. But as you get down to the ground, it's much messier, it's much more vital, there's much more sort of uncontrolled space, and that's how I wanted to approach the book. So I wanted to, we had 20 amazing interviews on the subject, all very diverse. There's not a bigger range than John Waters and Don Mishner, who produces that Super Bowl halftime. But the subject could contain that diversity. We also had a great core team, Mark Hacker, Molly Heinz, Chi Perlman, and an in-house editorial board allowed us to really pursue the subject with this group. When we intersected with Bruce, the breakthrough was realizing that this was a book about the fact that these are experiences you have to participate in. So we realized that the key was making this an invitation to participate. And in doing so, we had to develop a kind of two-dimensional language that would represent these awe-inspiring, amazing events. For the purposes of the book, and I'm sure there'll be a range of definitions of what spectacle means, for the purposes of this book, we define spectacle as live, participatory, man-made experiences that turbocharge reality, that create an opportunity for this awe-inspiring experience. And we really approached it as a lens, a designer's lens, up to this world to see what they felt like, what they were like, what was the common language, what was so thrilling about them, and yet the sort of paradox of lasting in our memory but not lasting in real time was quite extraordinary. And Bruce really allowed us to think about the language of the book. I'm going to run through it in about 2 minutes very quickly. It's organized in three main chapters. One is, what are spectacles? They're big, they're bold, and they're brief. And I'm going to talk about that. What do spectacles do? They connect us, they transform us, and they utterly immerse us. And the last chapter is an invitation to go out called Getting There. And it's, as you'll see, a calendar of 100 spectacles around the world and how to get there and what to do when you're there. So it invited you in. And the book became a matrix, a weave of the primary narrative with a series of sidebars that allowed us to tackle subjects around the subject. When we were dealing with circus, we could look at the Fiji mermaid, which is a kind of bizarre P.T. Barnum story. The abuse of spectacle, the statistics, the Holi festival, which you see on the images around us in India, which I'll mention briefly, but what is it that makes that compelling? So I want to start with a quick go through of the book to give you a sense of that. I guess I'm supposed to click this. Spectacles are big. It's an obvious point. But they're big in a way that allows us to see the world in a different way. The very size transforms our perception of what was there before. We're looking at Kumbh Mela, which is over 3,000 years old, is a Hindu ritual, a bathing ritual. Every 3 years this takes place. Every 12 years there's a Maha Kumbh Mela, which I guess is the most extraordinary sized event. And it's so big that you could only perceive it from a satellite. There were 70 million people over the course of 40 days, and on one day, 25 million people bathed in the Ganges River at the same time. We spoke to Nick Day, who took a lot of these pictures, a really interesting filmmaker, about a documentary he made. And the reports are, and all of the reports about this, were what was surprising is how amazingly serene it was, the level of sort of temporary city that was set up, 50 square miles of tent, 25 linear miles of temporary pontoon bridges, big on a scale that's hard to fathom. More familiar to all of us in New York is the Macy's Day Parade. And the reason I wanted to include this is the bigness of the Macy's Day Parade, in some ways, as my six-year-old pointed out to me, transforms the way the buildings look. I mean, the balloons are so giant, these mammoth balloons seem to shrink the city. And for a moment, they create this very magical connection. In addition to being big, spectacles are bold. Exuberant, brash, accessible, generous, and as Simon talks about in his interview, fills this need, this human need, for a kind of exuberant self-expression. Every 2 years in Brussels, they create the flower carpet, and it started in the 70s, so it's a relatively new ritual. 1 million begonias set up in 4 days, and the extraordinary pattern and color of these flowers sits in direct contrast to the kind of sobriety of the square and creates a new meaning for that place. Spectacles are brief. And for those who are designers, that's the most humbling aspect of spectacles. Because truly, as designers, we're looking for, in general, permanence, looking for structures that last. And what I think is so amazing about fireworks is they disappear as they're being made. They literally are a kind of magic in the sky. And they also point out one of the factors about many of these experiences, and that is that they get their power from being right on the edge of out of control. There is a thrill in being on that edge. And fireworks are essentially controlled warfare. The sound, the smell. We spoke to the Grucci's about fireworks, and I was amazed at the sophistication in the technology, but the essential event has stayed the same. Spectacles connect us. Anyone here familiar with Burning Man? Has anyone been to Burning Man? Well, Burning Man, for those who don't know it, it takes place in the middle of the desert. For the week that it's up, it's the second largest city in Nevada. And the structure of it, this circle, is Larry Harvey describes, who is the founder, and Kevin Kelly talks about it in really eloquent detail. The actual structure was formed unconsciously. That ring was formed so that people had equidistance around the main event. You connect because it's pedestrian and it's bicycle, so you can't go in your air-conditioned bubble to another air-conditioned bubble. You're forced and invited to participate and come in contact. Everyone is an artist. Everyone there participates. There are no viewers or no passer viewers. And the motto is, it rests lightly on the earth. And towards that end, everything you bring in, you take out, and when it's gone, nothing is left. Spectacles transform. We spoke at length to an amazing artist named Peter Menschel, who is probably the greatest artist working in this form. He works out of Trinidad, and he describes Carnival in Trinidad as transforming not just the people who participate, and again, closer to home, there's the Halloween parade, which I've been to as a viewer and been to as a participant. And once you're in mask and in costume, you have a very different view of the experience as a participant. And in Carnival, the people who operate and control and perform the mask, as it's called, are also the ones who make it. And they make it 2 or 3 months before. So the village or the town is transformed 2 or 3 months before by the making of the experience. It's transformed during the experience. And of course, there's an after effect, a kind of magic that continues. So they transform on a personal level, and they transform on a spatial level. And the last characteristic we looked at is spectacles immerse. They create a definitive momentary break from our whatever it is we're in our daily life. Sight, sound, smell surround us. And as an example of that, this is the Holi festival in India, which is also a Hindu festival around spring. And both Carnival and this are in some ways about rejuvenation and spring. And the entire world around this experience is colored. Dried plants, dried powders are used to color the ground, people, animals. It is a totally immersive experience. We end the book with Getting There. Anyone here go to the original Woodstock? Was it the same people who went to Burning Man?
My dad went.
Thanks for that. So Getting There is a chapter that has a calendar of 100 spectacles and then an in-depth look at 40 is an invitation to participate. I want to just end by showing a short 2-minute film in a second that we put together as a way to suggest what it's like to be there. But in hearing what John had to say about the screen, I have to admit I still have my BlackBerry in my pocket. I don't know who I think I'm going to get a message from up here or why it's so urgent, but I'm as technology addicted as anyone, and I think the virtual connection that we have in the world has allowed us to shrink the world. It's been amazingly powerful at connecting to things around the world we never knew about. We're more mediated than we've ever been, and I think paradoxically, it's useful to acknowledge and look at the power of live experience. unplanned, and the need to create spaces that contain it, that don't put everything in a neat control boxes. So let's take a look at the movie.
Congratulations, thank you very much. That was really terrific. To remind everyone, Simon Doonan, Julie Taymor, and David Rockwell. Would you go to Burning Man?
I would. And
you would.
And I probably will. What I'm now...
It's not like the wouldn't take the shoe off thing because you had to go on stage. Okay, great, good. You are one of us. Join us, brother. Join us. Yes.
We're planning to go to Burning Man. I mean, my personal travel schedule in relation to the book has gotten much more extensive. I have a 4-year-old and a 6-year-old, so we're looking at kind of easing in. I definitely am going to go to Carnival through Peter Menschel's eyes. You know, the Burning Man issue we talk a little bit about challenges our sense of comfort and our sense of participation, so yes, I will go.
Do you have a hunger for this kind of event being more accessible in this culture, or do you see it happening? I mean, certainly there are plenty of American events. I mean, the Macy's Parade you referred to, but there's certainly nothing on the scale of 25 million people next to one river.
I think what I have a hunger for is the deep sense of ritual that creates, and I think that's an incredible example in terms of scale. I don't think it needs to be at that scale. I thought the gates in Central Park was an amazing example of something very near and dear to all of us that transformed people's experience of something they knew before. And we were working on a restaurant on the 3rd floor of the Time Warner building looking down at it. And I knew it was coming. I'd seen drawings and had heard about it. And then when you see it from the air and when you got down into it, it was just magical. So whether it's big or small, it's about leaving the room for that kind of self-expression.
And it's also about just seeing, you know, whatever you think about it. I recall the media leading up to Gates and people, you know, the media that I was working in at the time, I mean, you know, orange stuff in the park. Why spend money on this? That's wacky, you know. And And yet, when you see the impulse to do something so out of the rhythm and the ordinariness and just something on a scale that just says, you know, where does that come from? It's exhilarating and it's very intuitive, even as it's unusual.
And in keeping, I think, with what was so amazing and magical about Central Park anyway. I mean, Central Park's a miracle that it's there and allows everyone to kind of congregate. There's random paths, there's planned events. So I think in some ways it made visible the choreography that was already there.
Julie, you say that transformation is a central idea in your work. I was transformed by Juan Darien at the Lincoln Center Theater years ago, and then I was so thrilled that you did the artwork for Lion King, which my little daughter Regan, you know, still talks about. And obviously you've moved on, you did the Frida Kahlo movie. Where does this idea of transformation come from? And you have a movie that's coming out actually next summer too as well, right? Yeah, in your life.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay. I spend... No, I don't feel like... Now am I on?
Just
keep talking.
Hello. Okay.
Hello?
Okay. I was a traveler since I was very young. I went to Paris when I was 16, but perhaps most importantly, I spent 4 years in Indonesia. So, and went to India, Sri Lanka, when I was 15, I think, and had an introduction to this kind of spectacle that is very religiously oriented. And living in Indonesia, I went for 3 months and spent 4 years there, mostly in Indonesia and some part of the time in Japan. I was going to stay in Japan, but the theater in Japan was more like in the West by that time, which was more organized and more associated with theatrical productions on stages, 2-hour, 3-hour productions.
Audience out here, stage.
Exactly.
Up here.
And when I went to Java and then subsequently to Bali, I was 21 years old and absolutely stunned.
How is it different in Bali?
Well, in Bali, there's no word for art. There's no separation. It's part
those
of life.
Poor people.
Isn't that sad?
How sad for them, yes.
So if you're a farmer, you also may be a dancer. You may be a musician and a tailor and a school teacher and a mask carver. And not that they haven't specialized by this time, this was a long time ago, but it was something you did as part of just being human. It was part of religion, Hindu religion in particular in Bali. And these performances, what we would call performances, went on all night long. They went on for 9 hours. And what I learned, we know about the Suzuki method of teaching music, that the child is there very early, and the father, by being there on the lap, well, this is what would happen in Bali. The children would be sitting on their parents' lap, and they would be getting the movement and the rhythm from a very young age. They would be hanging around. They'd be moving back. There was no separation from the front of the stage. There was no stage to the back of the stage.
Also, within that culture, there's an accessibility to the large aggregated spectacle that we don't really understand here. There's not a language for, you know what I'm going to do tonight? I'm actually going to go into this wild, wacky thing where the entire village is getting together. In fact, you move seamlessly from what you're doing during the day to these kinds of events at night.
Yes, one of the things that I remember being very actually annoyed by was that the theater, all the talk about theater or movies was on the arts and leisure page. That we would separate the arts to our leisure activity, as opposed to saying it's the most fundamental part of our life, and that you just can't breathe without it, that it was as important as breathing and eating and drinking. And that stunned me at age 21 to be living in a culture where it was absolutely fundamental. That didn't mean you had to pay attention. It's the other thing that I loved. I loved going to an all-night Wayan Kulit, which is the shadow play, and half the time the people are eating and flirting and running around, and then sometimes they would show up because, and I think all of these spectacles have a bit of that, it's about the socializing that goes on during them.
And that was the way opera used to be.
Absolutely, in Shakespeare.
I'm in Shakespeare.
You
it was
drink,
very much
you eat. The other night I went to the opera. Did I go to the opera? I think I was at the symphony, and I was moving my body to the music, and the woman next to me went like that. I wasn't allowed because I was disturbing her presence. It just annoyed the hell out of me. I couldn't. The music.
You were
made
in front
me
of
move.
Me. I was really. Was pissed
it?
Off.
It was very.
Yeah, it was so annoying. I just.
Or one geez. Time I remember laughing.
Who is that
in an
woman?
Opera.
My God.
Yeah. Right. But it is something. I think being in Indonesia at that point in my life, I'd been doing theater since I was 11 years old. I'd done it professionally. I'd been in the. Now I was in the Bread and Puppet Theater. And I was in those giant spectacles in Vermont in the open fields and also in the Vietnam, anti-Vietnam marches, being lost. I think this was when I decided I didn't like being in the spectacle because you're inside these giant puppets and you can't see anything. And I prefer, I think about it, I've been to Carnival in Rio. I haven't been to Burning Man. And I think as a creator, I have an incredible appreciation and wonder at it all, but I don't know how much I can let myself want to be in the mist. I'm amazed. I think I was when I was 21 and during that time, and now I've slightly
Did become, you take off your shoe earlier, or did you
Oh, not? Everything.
You did. Okay, good, great.
Everything. Yeah. I went, fell into a volcano that was live and had been taken out. I mean, it was a time where I didn't know if I'd ever come back to the United States.
Well, you got the people who get in the puppets, and you got the people who hang around outside the puppets. I mean, you know, it's good that there's a social differentiation. Simon, when you started doing windows at Barney's, from your background as an artist, you described that one of the things that you loved the most about it is that anybody could come to see the window.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, first of all, I'm very insulted that you called me an artist. I'm just horrified by that.
Saboteur?
Because I think, going to what you were saying, I think we tend to have a very masochistic relationship with art. You know, like, you can't move in your chair. You know, art is something that's dour and intimidating and obscurantist. And the whole merging of art with people's lives that you were describing, we need more of that, you know, because I think our relationship to art is very masochistic and sort of bizarre, and I think it sort of needs to change. Anyway, what I do is not really art. It's sort of some bizarre mixture of street theater and craft and design.
Yeah, that's totally unrelated.
So no, I'll thank you to mind
me.
Your language.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Don't call him an artist.
Yeah, no, I think there's an important distinction.
No, I mean,
I get a salary. There's a bunch of us that do it. It's sort of like I'm happy not to be, because of the associations that art has in our culture, where it is so sort of dour and obscurantist and non-communicative. I mean, right now at Barney's, we're working on our Andy Warhol windows, which are going to be our big holiday promotion. And, you know, I love Warhol because he's incredibly communicative and incredibly inclusive. And, you know, there's a guy who understood spectacle. Whereas now I think we moved away from that, and art's become this sort of codified, dour kind of world that isn't inclusive in the way that something like Burning Man is. I don't think of Burning Man as a bunch of artists. I think of them as a bunch of freaks on bicycles in the nude. And, you know, it's great. It's very akin to what I do. It's sort of a free thing that is more uncategorizable, but probably more aligned with street theater. Or
what's the most surprising thing that happened in front of one of your windows, or the most interesting sort of group that aggregated there, other than just tourists and, you know, people who want to come into Barney's and
dogs
buy
peeing on them?
Yeah,
kind of thing.
You can skip
well,
that part, yeah.
The best things are when things go wrong. You know, like we went through a period in the late 80s of doing a lot of these celebrity caricatures. You know, you were commenting earlier on the Margaret Thatcher is the Iron Lady in the S&M outfit. And during that period, we had this caricature of Bette Midler as a dancing Christmas tree clutching a menorah. Very inclusive. We were being inclusive. And Bette was in this side window, and I turned the motor on, and we all went outside to watch it, and there was a big crowd gathering, and all of a sudden, she started banging her head against the glass. And it was so fantastic. It was just 10 times better than when she wasn't banging her head against the glass. And it looked like it was going to break the window. And then at other times, I love putting food in the window, bread rolls, and because it's cheap. you know, we have very, not like you, our budgets are very small. And so we have to make things out of other things. So I'll call up Payard Bakery and say, give me all your dried bread rolls and we'll make like a designer's name out of it. And then you get vermin in the window. And people love vermin in the window. Like, they just, and you know they're gonna dine out on it.
Of course they do.
They're gonna dine out on it for weeks. Oh, I was outside Barney's. I just bought an Hermes handbag and, you know, Miss Fancy. And she sees a rat running through Barney's window or a mouse. So when things go wrong, it can really be like what you were saying, David was saying about spectacles being on the edge, being the thing that's about to explode. Or so that I think that's part of the thrill.
Well, the surprise is great. The idea that, you know, you never know what's going to happen. But it seems to me the use of celebrity by you particularly is a way of aggregating a kind of sort of shared experience. You don't revere the celebrities, particularly in the Iron Maiden costumes or the menorah Christmas tree kind of thing, or the Tammy Faye piece that you did.
I hate it was spectacular.
Right. Yeah. But there's a sense of bringing them down and also loving them at the same time. Celebrity is
absolutely
a very shared experience in America.
It was something I entered into purely because I understood that it communicated. Because the first one we ever did was when the Reagans were leaving the White House, and we had this Mrs. Reagan with her back to the window because I couldn't get her face right and she looked terrible. So we turned her around and she was saying goodbye to the, you know, looking out wistfully at the White House, blah, 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 holding her plane tickets. And people went nuts and it was all over the papers. And I thought, wow, that communicates to people. So it was purely, it wasn't paying an homage, absolutely. Ugh, quelle horreur. It was more recognizing that this really resonated with people. But that was something that began to happen in the 80s. Mm-hmm. You know.
David, how is Burning Man like NASCAR? Both are profiled in the book.
Not in very many ways. NASCAR is in there. I mean, it is a uniquely, it's a newly minted ritual. It's uniquely American. It's incredibly in your face. And what's fascinating about it isn't the race, it's the whole infield culture. You know, where there's some
infield, the people that are inside the track, right.
Hot, sweaty, pickup trucks turned into, they're like Simon's windows, pickup trucks turned into swimming pools. I mean, there's a kind of self-expression within this confined framework, and the nail art is unbelievable. Like huge nails with decals on it.
Fingernail art.
Yeah. So it's much more about the kind of self-expression that happens before the event and after the event. The event is really not the thing. It's the kind of collision that happens before that.
And Burning Man bans all commercialism. I mean, there's nothing allowed to be sold at Burning Man, yet if you were to not sell something or buy something at a NASCAR event, you'd probably be arrested.
And I'm sure Coke is working on the Burning Man thing to figure out how to solve that.
But what is the difference in a spectacle that is commerce-driven in some way versus a spectacle that is more spontaneous, that arises out of some cultural ritual, some religious ritual, some purely accidental kind of celebration?
What intrigued me is every person interviewed treats spectacles like a magnifying glass up to kind of personal choice, because you're declaring yourself in real time to participate. So it magnifies that which people think is hideous. I mean, if a spectacle does not appeal to your aesthetics, that's a magnified thing.
Wait a minute, what do you mean?
So when we spoke to Quincy Jones,
right,
who did a great interview in here, we mentioned Burning Man, and he said, oh my God, that's where they burn that thing, and people run around naked, and you know, it's like a horrible experience.
Not Quincy's thing.
Not
really.
Quincy's thing. So I think the fact that it is such an explosion of energy, that if it doesn't conform to your idea of right and wrong or your aesthetic inclination, that's magnified.
So you talk about the Olympic opening ceremony. I mean, it seems that you've got events that aggregate very specific people, you know, the Hindus in India, the events here. I'll take the mic. I don't know what's going on here. I hope I don't feedback. And And then you've got NASCAR, which is a very specific subculture that is probably not going to include a lot of people outside of that subculture. But then you've got the Olympic opening ceremony, which attempts to unite a global audience, and if you include the television audience, brings 4 billion people together in some way.
There's a few things that were surprising that link all the experiences. And one of them was, which shocked me, in speaking to Don Mishner, who all he does is larger-than-life Super Bowl halftime. He was the one who did the convention where the balloons didn't come down, which was not a happy experience.
I'm sure he's glad you're reminding us all of that.
Take a bow, Don.
Yeah, take a bow.
But he talked about the Olympic ceremonies in Atlanta, which I believe is the one where Ali lit the torch, Muhammad Ali, who he also spoke to about that in the book. And what he described was that when you're producing an event, what you're trying to do is control every single facet to allow for two or three spontaneous unplanned moments. And that it's that spontaneous piece, and that in fact, in the case of Ali, no one knew he was going to do that. So I think there's that uncontrollable factor that goes through, you know, NASCAR, there's the crashes, and clearly there's an element of danger in it.
And there's the people who've been drinking for 4 or 5 days. That's a sort of a surprise, uncontrolled element.
That runs through a lot of the events.
Yeah, that runs through a lot of the events, yes. Julie, you know, in some of the events that are described in here, producers of big events say, you know, we handed flashlights out to, you know, 50,000 people in the audience, and they flashed them, and wow, that was amazing. Or we handed bells to people and asked them to ring at a particular time, and that was the most memorable part. And the shoes thing, right? But I would think that, you know, we have to constantly be reminded in this era of special effects and giant lighting and technology and screens and megatrons that those simple things are really so much more powerful. Why is that?
That's one of the reasons that I keep moving back and forth from cinema, film, to live theater, because there is something, when people say to me in The Lion King, about The Lion King, that the first 5 minutes was the most moving thing, it's sort of a drag, first of all, you say, oh, what about the other 2 hours and 35 minutes? But you wonder because there's no story in the first 5 minutes. It's all about making a space come alive and the visceral experience of the theater, a beautiful theater, I might add, the original one. But the idea that people are seeing the magic, you know, when you say the visual effects and all, I do a lot of visual effects, but not all of them cost a lot. Something like Juan Darien originally, maybe now a few of them are bigger budget, but there is also the most inexpensive, as you say, it's the idea that a little shadow puppet carved out of, not even carved, cut out of cardboard on a stick with a light bulb moves across the space, and that the audience is aware of the strings of what it is, and yet it's transformed. You asked about transformation. They go with you. They know they're in a live theater, but all of a sudden they are ready to suspend their disbelief.
Yeah, more for a sock puppet than for a human actor.
Absolutely, but why people have to go to church or synagogue or a mosque is because the environment, even this room, the environment that they're in, being next to people is a whole part of the experience. I was thinking the other night as the Mets were losing.
That was last night,
yes.
Sweetheart. Yeah, that was last.
I don't really like to watch baseball.
4 hours ago.
Yeah,
exactly.
Look, I know that.
Right.
Yes. Part of our household is very, very upset. And me too. But I don't like to watch baseball on TV. But I love to go to the baseball game. So what's the difference? Everybody knows. It's not just the hot dogs, but that has a lot to do with it. But it is being in the space, in the crowd. Our biggest spectacles are constantly happening are our sports, or our boxing, or football, or baseball, or hockey. And why do people not get content with just watching them on the two-dimensional screen? Because they like that experience and the experience of danger and that you don't know what's going to happen. Circus is the same. Live theater has that. The lights might, oh, I had this whole thing with Grendel you might have read about in this wall, and oh, maybe it's going to break. There's something so exciting about that moment of it not being canned and perfect.
Well, it's a call to be in the moment.
Yes,
there's
absolutely.
There's no other moment you can be in because that moment's not going to repeat.
Right. What's the Bette Midler whacking her head against the window moment? I mean, we can coin that right now, I think. You know, talking about the suspension of disbelief, and I think there is something going on in America particularly and in Western culture where I think the screen's dominance, people are reacting to it. People are trying to climb outside of the screen. Museum attendance is through the roof, partly because it's such an experiential kind of an event. People can go and there's lots happening. You can take your friends. But nevertheless, politicians, and particularly 20th century politicians, have used spectacle and aggregations of crowds for very frightening ends. And I wonder if it worries you to be in a giant crowd of people chanting about their favorite shoe. You know, who knows what they'll be doing tomorrow. Simon?
Absolutely. You know, I find... I haven't been to any of those sort of Albert Speer type rallies. I don't know what kind of life you think I'm leading. Was that what you meant? Well,
no, but I think a lot of people in America look at giant crowds of people chanting and, you know, think of government control, think of, you know, Stalinism, think of Nazism, think of hyper-nationalism, think of phenomena that are spectacle, that are powerful, that are memorable, that satisfy all of these criteria, but yet have very, very dangerous sort of implications.
Yeah, well, I think those sort of totalitarian displays that you're talking about, they're, in a funny kind of a way, they're the opposite of living in New York, because living in New York is just big old mayhem 24 hours a day. I mean, I took the subway ride here, and it's just a completely unchoreographed spectacle. It's like the anti-fascist kind of spectacle. So that's why it's so odd to think of being in some like demented North Korean parade in a funny outfit. So it could be kind of
or
chic.
The Mall of America. There you go.
No, America doesn't really have stuff like that, I don't think, because it's not that kind of culture. America is, a few years ago, I went down to the Bahamas, and there's this resort there called the Ocean Club, and it's very she-she, and it's designed by Christian Lieger, and it's very zen and minimal and blah, blah, blah. And then you walk down the beach, you think, well, this is nice, but it's a bit sort of tight-assed. I mean, it might be the vice word. So you walk down the beach, and there's Atlantis, you know, and there are people on jet skis with their children's faces tattooed on their back. And they're riding along, they're having fun, and there are shark tanks and people flying through tubes. And you think, great, I'm back in America. I'm not in some terrible withhold. Because style can be very antithetical to enjoying a spectacle. In order to enjoy a spectacle, you have to surrender all that bullshit and surrender to it. And I think what you were saying about Quincy Jones' aesthetics, and I don't know, he needs to like leave his aesthetics.
He needs to get out
home.
More.
And, yes.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, why, David, does Vegas make it into the book? One of the people that you interview about Las Vegas, who lives in Las Vegas, describes America as being fundamentally ugly from coast to coast, and that Vegas, from his perspective, hasn't been to Yosemite, I guess. Vegas, from his perspective, is a place that is committed to an idea of beauty that he really responds to.
That's an art critic named Dave Hickey who has made his living out of that point of view, eccentric though it might be. Vegas is in there, it's the closest thing to architecture that's in the book. And it's in there because, you know, to sort of tie into what Simon was saying about Atlantis, Vegas, first of all, the skyline is constantly changing. It's not about a permanent skyline. The population is largely tourist. It's really an ephemeral experience that never intended to be a pedestrian experience. You know, these were air-conditioned bubbles, and what people found was the most interesting thing was going, sort of moving around, and it became this bizarre pedestrian experience.
Bizarre is not even the word. I was at a Steve Wynn hotel, I think it was the Bellagio, I think, and they have this, maybe it's another one, but anyway, you get them all mixed up, but there's this like Venice Canal inside, right? And there's a restaurant there, and the restaurant has an inside, and then there's an outside by the canal, and there's this like painted sky, and I was trying to get a seat there. I was at a conference for something or another, and literally there was this heated argument going on about this one couple who insisted on having a table outside. Not inside, outside. And they were, and the waiters were, I mean, talk about suspension of disbelief. You know, I want outside. I don't want to be inside. I want outside. I mean, they were identical. And why does that work?
I'll tell you. I was just there, and I said to the concierge, oh, well, where's the Grand Canal? Because I'd heard about that. I wanted to see all that inside-outside thing. And he said, it's on the second floor. So, how fabulous.
It's a viaduct, I guess, yeah. Right? It's called plumbing. It's not a canal. You know, Steve Wynn, in the interview in this book, describes as his metaphor, his sort of template for Las Vegas, as New York City. Do you buy that?
Well, Steve is fabulous and is a terrific, amazing salesman. I think more interestingly, he describes Vegas as having no context. And that for no context. I mean, it is this almost single-purpose place built in the middle of a desert without context, and therefore there's permission. But I actually think the reality of Vegas is sort of flat-footed compared to the fantasy of it, in that once you build a building in the shape of a pyramid, you're sort of stuck with that pyramid. And I think what Steve was talking about was changing the relationship of theater, that the performance was the hotel looking at the city as the audience was the hotel looking at the performance of the city. I think it was a stretch. I don't think it's anything like New York. And I think that's a good thing.
Yeah,
I think the misery of Vegas, I think Vegas is a miserable place. And I think the misery of it comes from the fact that with any spectacle, there's a really sad aspect to every spectacle because it ends and then you're out at the bus
exactly.
stop in the rain going home, right? So in England, they have this expression, after the Lord Mayor's show comes the ship cart. And it's a little bit vulgar, but it does make a very good point that every spectacle ends, so there's an intrinsic sadness in every spectacle. So in Vegas, you have that magnified, and you're living with that 100 times over everywhere you go. So that sadness of like that it's not real, it's going to end, is multiplied a billion times. I think that's why people have mood swings when we're there. They're there.
I think all spectacles in some way can be seen as the same. The Festival of Holi for, I don't know how long it lasts, but it's topsy-turvy for a limited amount of time.
Right.
You're a poor worker, and all of a sudden, you're able to throw all this paint on your boss. You're able to become a woman if you're in. It takes the banal everyday life and gives you a moment of respite. I think that's what religion is supposed to do. I think that's why it's so powerful, because you go into a church for a moment and you're singing with everybody else and you feel transported. So whether we like Vegas or not, it doesn't really matter. I think the thing about Vegas that what we're talking about in the architecture is it's so controlled and so fabricated, the only danger is losing your money on gambling, and that's what makes Vegas stay Vegas. If it was simply a park of that structure, I don't think it would work. I think what's there is the danger of the maybe the promise of sexuality or sensuality, and the fact that people are gambling. And it from the outside, and it obviously is very sad. But on the other hand, it draws people so and back again. It's not something that people
trying to figure out how to separate out the gambling in Vegas is.
But
you know,
the fact is, in Vegas, the percentage of income spent on gambling is radically different than it used to be. It used to be 80 or 90%. It's now 30% or something.
It's the entertainment.
And we were in this on this project for MGM where they said they wanted to create a city-like experience. So there were a bunch of us that said, why don't we create the world's greatest park? I mean, you know, Vegas needs a public place where these, and so the client thought about it. He said, well, that's good, but you got to add the retail in somehow. I mean, not crazy.
But that's what frustrates me about Vegas, in the sense that, I mean, if you look at the experiences in this book and think about art going way back in history, I mean, in a sense, all of the art forms were originally detached from this idea of object and commerce. I mean, literature was an oral tradition. It was something that arose out of a gathering. Theater was always a gathering. Cinema, you know, is basically a proto-theatrical experience. I mean, and music was always gathering, was always live performance. The idea in the age of recorded music that the music is an object is fundamentally at odds with all of human history in some way. And it seems that this return to spectacle is a kind of a realignment back to the way things sort of more naturally and intuitively are.
If you think about churches, they're a building form that in some way was formed around a ritual and a procession. So it kind of embraced a set of rituals. And for me, going back to the things that were experienced in the book make me really rethink. You know, the thing that Vegas is missing are many of the qualities that these experiences have that deal with ephemeral. We went to the Brussels flower carpet, and I have a little film if you want to
see it. Yeah, no, I want to see that in a second.
And it was just extraordinary how much impact that carpet of flowers had in transforming a space. And there is not, at the moment, that happening in Vegas, but...
But it's very, very different from Vegas and some of the events that you describe in here, and the sadness that you describe, Simon. I think perhaps it relates to the idea that in a market-driven context where commerce is driving the event, there is this sense of next year we have to outdo what we did last year. We have to have more, you know, dancing girls, or okay, we did the pyramid, but we have to do the pyramid and we have to get a hooker or something, you know. I mean, I don't know what it is, but there's a sense that you have to outdo, whereas the Hindu experiences that you talk about, the Balinese experience that you just, people, and the Brussels flower thing, which I want to see in a second here, you can go back to it again and again, and there's not the need to have next year be better than last year.
You could say the same about museums, too. The attendance is up, and museums are a much bigger deal in terms of these major icons. But the content, you know, the content that draws them, the buildings in some ways dwarf the content. And thinking about the kind of, if you think about Vegas, the buildings dwarf any human-driven experience. And that's an interesting thing to look at. Is there, can you create the environment around the experience?
The best spectacles, the most powerful spectacles, it seemed to me, create both a sense of newness and nostalgia at the same time, that you're both going forward and going back when you experience the event. And I think a lot of the more anxiety-producing experiences in our culture don't have that. And a lot of these wonderful, I mean, Burning Man, for instance, has created a kind of Hindu, you know, people who go back, right. I mean, people who go once and hate it, that's one thing, but the people who go back again and again aren't trying to outdo the last time they were there. They don't want a bigger Burning Man or more naked people to walk by. I mean, they aren't really looking for that experience.
I think the other thing that we've often, let's say, critics are going to a theater piece and they'll say in a derogatory way that it's spectacle, and it's used as a word as something that's empty, that it means it has no content, it's purely packaging or something. Like we're not Hindus, so we're just looking in awe at these pictures, but it really isn't about that. I think that's, from the outsider it may be, but from the insider it's very hard to talk about spirituality. Because you either get it or you don't. It's either part, and I'm not talking about organized religion, I'm talking about what that experience is. And some spectacles are sheerly there as that moment, but what happens to the people is that they get a rise out of being in it. And whatever that may be, whether it's feeling that you're connected with your religion, your God, or whatever, it's that transformation of the human experience. That is it, and that is what we call spirituality. It's a word that is, it's a hard word like ritual and art. I want to say that I feel so sad every time when I do these movies or this and that, and they say it's art. It's like a scarlet letter, you know, a big A, art. It's exactly what you said, which means in some ways it's.
There are no
be.
Artists on this stage.
I'm very
okay.
proud to
there
be
absolutely
an artist. I
no
hope,
art.
But
it's not a big A.
But I think that it's very sad that we do feel that there is this disconnect. We look at these pictures and we go, it's so beautiful. What is it about that not only is it this experience, but there's an aesthetic beauty to it. And I have felt, though I really love the wonderful things about technology that we have, when we say this, America has become ugly, well, there's so many beautiful parts of America, but what has happened where we've lost our sense of aesthetic appreciation in
just
a way.
Just being drawn to beauty in this wonderful, whimsical kind of way. Simon, I'm interested, what's the biggest event you've ever attended?
Well, we had our own Woodstock in England. It was called the Isle of Wight Pop Festival, and Jimi Hendrix played, and Sly and the Family Stone. I went to that, because I'm very old. No. That was pretty big. That's not very interesting, is it?
No, it's fine.
My tawdry.
No, tell me more. Well, let's.
Oh, and they had the interesting part was watching all these people contend with latrines. You know, nobody talks about that at Pop Festival. That was the real spectacle.
Actually, there's a lot of discussion. There's a lot of discussion of latrine organization in this book. Let's look at the Belgian.
Can I just tie in one thing, sure, Lisa, that, yep, I think, because you and I got into this discussion, and when you think about windows or the notion of story in a lot of these events are backstory. If you go to a celebration, you're bringing it your belief to the reason you're going there. So in some ways, these are the kind of, you know, apex of a whole backstory in history, whether that story is explicit or not.
Let's see the movie of the Belgian carpet, and I think you get a sense in the motion here of just how the space is transformed. Could you roll that film? That was great. That was the Belgian national anthem there, I think. Yeah, no, not quite. So the last part of your book, before we go, I want to remind people, is an invitation to experience festivals and spectacles of one kind or another. How many people do you think will take you up on that offer, and what is it that you want to experience based on writing this book? And I'll just go down the line here.
There's a whole list. Probably the first thing I'm going to do is go to, just because of the process of dealing with Peter Menschel, I want to go and see that and experience that next year. But there's 10 or 15 things. The Blue Angels seems like an amazing event. And then there's things I want to go back to. I love sports, so I'm hoping to go to the Super Bowl this year if I can get away.
Julie?
Where I want to go?
Yep. What spectacle is coming up in your life that you could talk about?
I don't know, actually. You know, I've been to Carnival 3 times in Brazil. I want to go to India. I've been when I was younger, but I really want to go back to India. I think I have a project, but also just to travel there and experience that. Besides that, I have to read his book again, the end of it, and pick a spectacle to go to.
Simon.
I want to see Julie Taymor with that little cutout puppet and the light bulb, because that's my idea of a spectacle. It's the opposite of Vegas.
The opposite of Vegas, right.
God.
Well, Simon Doone and Julie Taymor and David Rockwell, thank you very much. And thanks to Paul Holden Graber, our master of ceremony.
We invite you all to stay for the reception, mingle with these wonderful people. I think tonight is an omen to the notion of spectacle. You've come out here to be together. In some way, what Bruno Bettelheim once said about television, he said that television captures the imagination but doesn't free it. We need to be together. We need to touch each other. As I often say, you can't tickle yourself. You need other people. Try to tickle yourself. Now, tickle yourself. Try. You can't. You need other people. So stay around. Mingle with these people. David Rockwell will also sign his book. Please stay and come back soon. Bye-bye.